This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Wizard of Oz to Wicked, adaptations and reimaginings in speculative fiction.
And we are very pleased to invite back to the podcast Hamish Ridley Steele, or Hamish Steele, I believe that's your pen name, is that right?
Hamish Ridley Steele isn't even an official name. I just put it on Facebook for a sign of, I don't know, something cool and different.
I just think it's a cool name, so it's got a nice ring to it. I mean, Hamish Steele is also a cool name. It's a very steampunk name, I feel.
Hey, I mean, Ridley is the surname of my husband, so we both did it as a kind of sign of marriage.
Of love, yeah. of companionship. Love. Welcome back to the show, Hamish.
Thank you.
Really great to have you back on.
I'm very pleased to be back. I listen every week and I always want to have my say on whatever topic it is. So it's always nice to be able to be heard back, I suppose.
And you did give us the idea for our anniversary episode. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. It was really nice to listen to. I love dragons. I love big fat lizards. Everyone knows that.
I'm still trying to get over Madeline's cartoon of winged snakes, to be quite honest.
I have no problem with winged snakes. I think it works. I'm a straight behind the heads kind of person, though.
Okay, you're a number one in that scenario. Yeah. Jules is number three for some reason.
Well, I didn't think of it until you did it, and I was like, "That's awesome! You know, I really like that."
Yeah, my partner Sean is also number three. I've yet to meet anyone who's a number two, though.
I think that's universally agreed to be stupid.
It's just dumb.
Don't go that far.
So, yeah, thank you for coming back onto the show. Since you were last on, you've been up to all sorts of things.
Yeah. So I'm still doing my webcomic. I'm still an animation director, but I'm currently working on two big projects, and both of which are sort of adaptations of books.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, I suppose, is quite exciting. I'm working on an adaptation of the L. Frank Baum's Wizard of Oz book series.
Oh.
But I can't say anything else really about that. But I've posted sort of Oz art here and there. And anyone that knows me knows that I've always been kind of developing an Oz adaptation all my life because I'm very fascinated by the books.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the first time I tried to adapt it was as a video game when I was a teenager. I felt that sort of traveling to a magical world and having a party of slightly strange heroes with you felt very video gamey in some sense.
Yeah.
So it's always been with me as a point of interest.
That is interesting because you get a lot of Alice in Wonderland kind of video games and adaptations. So it would actually make sense to have a Wizard of Oz video game. I think that would actually work quite well. I'm going to steal that idea. Thanks.
Future project.
Maybe there'll be a game based on my adaptation I'm working on right now. Ah, maybe
indeed.
Who knows?
You have connections in the gaming industry, Liam. Why did I call you Liam? With Liam. Through me. I'm getting people mixed up.
That's fine.
And what is this other project you've been working on?
Don't know if I can really say, but it's
international artist of mystery, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, that one's adapted from a very recent series of children's books, and I've been doing stuff with some really cool people. I directed Simon Pegg and Nick Frost a couple of weeks ago.
Oh God, so envious.
It's fun. I feel like I'm really living up to the animation director title right now. And also, just to keep talking about all the amazing, great things in my life, My first graphic novel comes out in April, which itself is kind of an adaptation of Egyptian mythology, and I self-published it, but it's being published by a comic publisher called Nobrow, and I think you can pre-order it or get it in bookshops if you ask and things.
Fantastic. And that's Pantheon.
Yes, that's Pantheon, the true story of the Egyptian deities.
Which I feel I must, you know, put in my two cents for this. It is one of the most accurate, apart from the one bit where guns appear. It is one of the most accurate retellings of the Egyptian myths.
It is probably genuinely educational.
Yeah, probably because you actually managed to capture the original humor and snark that was actually, you know, very prevalent in the original mythology, which is kind of, everyone sort of went, no, it's meant to be very serious. It's like when people say that Shakespeare is very serious, and I'm like, it's 90% dick jokes and puns. Yeah.
No, I try to keep that all in, and there's nothing confirmed or anything, but I am hoping to do a Norse sequel. So I'm trying to do as much reading as research as possible.
You are ticking all the boxes, Hamish.
If you want some ideas of favourite myths and things to include, we can give you some.
I was actually going to ask you to, as almost be unofficial. Well, you'll definitely be on the thank you page. Because for Pantheon, for first one, I was doing Egyptian mythology research for about 5 years just in my spare time. And now I feel like I've got to do all of that again in 1 year.
Gosh.
So, yeah.
That said, the Norse myths are a little bit better recorded.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like they're proper stories. In Pantheon, there's a lot of rearranging and making stuff not contradict each other so much and things like that.
Yeah, which is a problem with mythology, is almost constant contradictions. So yeah, I think in that sense, we could definitely label Pantheon as an adaptation, because you've taken a lot of the source material and sort of repackaged it for a modern audience. Mm. In a very faithful way, and in a way that it stands alone. And that's one of the things we're going to be talking about, is actually what makes a successful adaptation. Now, I feel we should probably go back, because we did mention within the title that we're going to be looking in particular at that sort of The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't talk too much a bit about your project, because you're a tease, so free it up.
And non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, that's pretty compelling, in fairness.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you are a big fan of books. And there are a lot of adaptations. So
two that would be good to look at probably are the musical with Judy Garland in and Wicked, which are two completely different interpretations.
I mean, even the movie itself, and I'd like to hear what you think about these adaptations, and what do you think about the books themselves? Because some of the books are actually could be considered adaptations too, couldn't they?
So I like to make certain terms quite clear, and these are my readings of terms, and I don't think they're universally acknowledged. But I see sometimes people use the words remake, reboot, adaptation kind of interchangeably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I feel a remake is when you take one particular source material and try and make it again in the same medium. So a film, turning a film into another film, like a new film. A reboot is when you take a franchise and kickstart it, and you can do that with a remake or a sequel or a prequel. It's just about making a franchise relevant again, I suppose.
Yeah.
And an adaptation, I feel, is taking one bit of source material and turning it into a different medium. So, for example, what I'm trying to say is you get sometimes people saying, for example, Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory wasn't a remake of the Gene Wilder one. It was another adaptation of the books.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think people get one of the things that's interesting about The Wizard of Oz is people really view the Judy Garland 30s movie as the original source material quite a lot. Mm-hmm. they often don't know there is a book series, let alone 40 odd books. And I feel it gets a lot of remake or reimagining, where I think reimagining is a remake where you're intentionally trying to change aspects to make it interesting, such as Wicked. And I feel like, for example, Wicked does use a bit of the books as a source material, but I think it takes a lot of imagery from the film specifically.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Its whole branding is around the sort of the green Wicked Witch, which isn't green in the books.
No.
And I think that's the Judy Garland film. My only shred of resentment about it is how much it has overshadowed the books. One interesting thing about the Judy Garland film, it was actually the 8th film adaptation of The Wizard of Oz.
I didn't realize it
was that many.
L. Frank Baum, who wrote the books, actually started his own film production company to make adaptations of his books, mostly silent films, which were very black and white and very low budget. And there was a few other attempts. It was the first color version. And
that's why they did the red shoes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, the Technicolor.
Yes, they made a few changes, and I don't mind the changes. I feel it does capture a lot of an idea of the books and is very faithful in other places. But I guess because it was such a huge cultural sort of touchstone, I suppose it has become The Wizard of Oz, whereas in a way that I don't think, I was about to say something I don't agree with. I think there's a lot of adaptations which do overshadow the books, and often people don't even know that there's a book.
Yeah.
And I think that is one example of it. So I as a fan of the books, and I do not think the books are very perfect, I think that I find them fascinating in a way that isn't completely derived from the fact I think they're amazing bits of literature.
Yeah.
They do read a little bit like they're being made up on the spot. And I think that is part of the appeal. It has a very kind of stream of consciousness sort of feel. It's full of contradictions in almost the same chapter where they mention that nobody can die in Oz, not even animals. The Tin Man kills a cat. it's very strange. And that is part of the charm, and that's part of the fun of adapting it. But as someone who is a big fan, and one of the reasons I wanted to adapt it myself, is I feel the Judy Garland film being used as the source material for all future Oz projects means that there's this kind of untapped potential to do a faithful or a more faithful adaptation of the books.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's something in the books that never seems to have really translated in any adaptation. I mean, obviously, I don't know about all the previous films to the Judy Garland one.
Yeah.
But it hasn't really shown up in the musical of Wicked, which I know, again, is an adaptation of an adaptation, basically. And that's there's this sort of callous practicality about a lot of the characters in the books. There's not a lot of hand-wringing about killing people, for example. It's a case of, oh, right, well, they're sort of blocking my path and I need to get them out of the way, so I guess I'll just go and kill them then, you know?
Your scarecrow snaps the neck of 40 crows.
Yeah, I mean, I found that a little dark as a child, even with the healthy callousness of a child.
Yeah.
I think I remember one of my absolute favourite lines in the books was at one point they're like, well, all right, we're off to go and kill the witch. And the guard who's there just looks and goes, oh, I don't think she'll like that. I just really laughed.
And they're willing to do it almost on hearsay. It's like, yeah, Someone's told them the witch is wicked. Well, I guess she's wicked then.
Yeah, it's the blithe way. It's just this young child looks up at this grown adult and goes, well, I'm off to go and kill someone. And he just goes, oh, I don't think that's, she'll, not, I don't think that's a very good idea. Just, I don't think she'll like that. Come on.
One of my favorite little sort of book details is the Tin Man's origin story, where he chopped off each limb one by one and got it replaced one by one until he was completely made of tin.
Yeah.
And he no longer loved his fiance because he didn't have a heart. But when he sort of gets his heart or feels like he's better, he goes back to see his fiance, and she has married all his body parts stitched together.
I'd forgotten that bit.
Which is horrifying.
That is horrifying. I mean, the bit with the cowardly lion, actually, when they're in the forest and the lion is killing this, it's a huge spider, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a case of, waits till the spider's asleep. And I'm like, okay, now I can admire, again, the practicality and the ruthlessness of that. But at the same time, part of me is going, cowardly lion, and now you have courage, but your courage comes from the fact you're killing it in its sleep.
Just because he has courage doesn't mean that he's got, you know, nobility.
Good point.
I think this is one reason why I'm not drawn to adaptations which try to advertise themselves as a dark reimagining of The Wizard of Oz, because I feel it's dark enough, and so that's what I want to show. And like, one of my favorite adaptations is Return to Oz.
Yeah.
Which I feel captures, even though it's quite unfaithful to the plot, it captures a very odd vibe that does leave a lot of people after watching it feeling a little bit bleak and weird. To me, that feels like Oz.
I'd agree with that. Nobody really wins in that particular film. And it does have this sort of, you know, the original sort of feel of a fairy tale where bad stuff happens and one set of people win and the other people don't. But, you know, it's kind of a hollow victory, really. Because you can't help being a little bit sympathetic towards, I want to say it's the Gnome King, but I'm not sure it is.
Well, yes, there is. It is the Gnome King.
Yeah.
There's. I'm not watching it because I'm currently working on an Oz project and I have to kind of be in a bit of a bubble. But yeah, there is a new TV series that's come out which wants to be Wizard of Oz meets Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's quite edgy.
Which is
Emerald City, is that right?
Yeah, I actually read the script I kind of was reading things about it because we all worried about it doing our own Oz project. But as soon as I saw the trailer and saw a kind of scarecrow on a crucifix covered in blood and all these kinds of things, I realized that we were on very different paths. But I think it's cool. I think, like, I do think there's something about the books and the film which makes people want to add to them in a way. It feels like a kind of a lump of clay that hasn't quite decided what to be.
Conscious lump of clay. I would tend to agree with you, and maybe in the same way that of fairy tales, and, you know, in the same way of mythology, actually, there's this sense of, perhaps it's because they're so contradictory throughout. I mean, the Wizard of Oz books constantly are contradicting themselves in the same way that we were just talking about how mythology is constantly contradicting itself. Perhaps that's really what kind of helps make it so pliable for adaptation, because you could just read it in so many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, Oz does belong in a kind of Oz does exist in a kind of I've listened to stage plays, I've seen concept album music video adaptations, there's obviously stage plays. I think it is filled with enough archetypal I don't even know what I'm saying, but I feel like it can be. I'm adapting Wizard of Oz now, trying to make it a definitive version, but knowing full well that next year there'll be another one. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, there's so much potential with it as a series.
Yes.
As a series of books, as a story, that you can really take it in whatever direction you feel it needs to be taken in, which is quite nice. So I've been to see Wicked twice, and I quite like it because probably I really appreciated the music for it, and the visuals were quite, you know, spectacular as well as far as stage performance goes. It is quite a good one. Having only read really the first of the books and only sort of knowing the, you know, the Wizard of Oz for a sort of a second acquaintance, you know, I wasn't that acquainted with it as such. Maybe that permitted me to actually enjoy it more. So I'd be interested to see what you thought of it as I'm going to call you a diehard fan. That sounds quite forceful, but you know what I mean? As someone who sort of really knows a lot more about the books and the series in general.
Well, I went to see it quite a few years after it sort of came out. And I really did enjoy it as a night out, a stage show and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to read the Book of Wicked, which is definitely dense, and it's definitely something. I thought it was interesting that Wicked is an adaptation of an adaptation, because
of an adaptation.
Yeah, it's all very. I mean, actually, one thing I appreciated about the Wicked book was that it felt more in the world of the books in a way. But yeah, I did like it. I've tried to explain what being a Wizard of Oz fan is to people, and I've usually used this metaphor. And I say, imagine being a fan of Harry Potter, but the only adaptation anyone cares about is a 100-year-old film which only adapts half the first book, Voldemort's Bright Red, Hogwarts is a beach hut, Harry Potter's scar is just a circle, and it's filled with songs. And instead of ever trying to adapt the rest of the books, you instead get edgy reimaginings about why Voldemort wasn't really all that bad, films in which the sexy Dumbledore flirts with McGonagall and things. I think that's what it feels like, because, for example, I don't mind Wicked that much. I had a problem with Disney tried to do a prequel called Oz the Great and Powerful a few years ago.
Yeah, I did see that.
And the wizard has a full origin story that's quite interesting throughout the books, but they don't use any of that. And they take one of the few book series in which only female characters ever accomplish anything or have a agency, and make it all about some dude who, like, I don't know, gets everything
womanizing.
He wants. Yeah, who gets everything he wants except despite being a jerk. And yeah, I felt that was an example where Oz looked great and it included lots of characters and elements from the books which I'd never seen adapted, but it was so far removed from the message or the tone or the purpose of the books.
Yeah.
And I think if you want to talk about faithfulness, the thing about adaptations I always try and make clear is that faithfulness does not equal good.
Yeah.
And faithfulness also can be the faithfulness of a story, of the characters, or of the message, and sometimes things can get one thing right and not really another thing.
Yeah. No, I would agree with you, because I like to cite that looking at a lot of the Studio Ghibli movies.
Yeah.
A lot of them are actually adaptations. You know, Howl's Moving Castle is an adaptation.
Tales of Earthsea.
Yeah, there are a lot of them are adaptations. And in particular of Howl's Moving Castle, because I know the book. Diane Wynne Jones, that is her name. Diane Wynne Jones really loves the film, and the film is very different from the books, but it managed to capture a lot of the essence and the aesthetic. And when they were going into it, they knew that it was going to be different. It was the same characters, but the characters are also a little bit different. But it really captured kind of elements of the soul of the story, even as it changed so much.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was largely true to the main characters, and it was true to the idea of you've got this rather callow sort of main male character who is a bit of a coward and can't come straight in at things. He's got to sort of come in sidelong, telling himself he's not going to do it, right up until the point he's actually locked in deadly combat. And a female character who is just gloriously crotchety and actually quite enjoys hiding behind the fact that she's been cursed to be an old woman, because that means she doesn't really have to deal with any of the problems of being young.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing with adaptations is they need to stand on their own. You need to be able to watch a film and understand the characters and the plot and get what it's about, regardless whether you've watched or read the book before.
Yeah.
And films and books are such different mediums that sometimes changes are a bit necessary for the sake of making a good film.
Yeah, I agree. And this brings me round to something else that, you know, Hamish, we've actually talked about this before, and it's the Harry Potter films. And you made me aware of this, you made me really think about it, that the Harry Potter films are actually not very good adaptations.
Well, I saw all the films before I read the books and found myself often very confused. And I think they're adaptations in that I feel that the scenes themselves and the characters are faithful, but they just chop out a lot of elements, which makes them all a bit disjointed, and
yeah,
they always feel like way longer than they are. And they're definitely an example of where the books themselves, they work. The pacing of the books are great, and it's very episodic and enjoyable that way. But as films, it doesn't quite make for an entertaining time.
No, it works on the assumption that you have all read all of the books. Which...
Yeah, they're more like companions to the books rather than standalone adaptations. Because actually, they don't really stand alone. It's as you say, and thinking about it now, I rewatched them recently. If I hadn't read the books, I would have not understand, especially, you know, towards the end.
It's like, yes, I am the Half-Blood Prince. I think that's the only time that got mentioned in the entire film.
Yeah, it's just that it was... And there was, they never even talked about the mirror. Suddenly in the last film, Harry's got this mirror and he keeps seeing a reflection in it. And I was just there like, you didn't, this is the first time you've brought up the mirror. Like it, and I thought if I hadn't read the books, I really wouldn't understand what was going on. And I kind of, that was really extenuated for me when I was watching the film. And every time something happened, I paused it and I was there like, oh, and this is thing in the books to Sean. And that kind of we had to sort of know all the backstory from the books in order to enrich the experience of watching the films.
It's something that I don't necessarily think, it's not obvious to me that it could have been done miles better, because I think the books just balloon in size beyond anything an adaptation can really cover. I think they would be much more successful films if they were less faithful and really focused themselves. But I think they kind of wanted to have their cake and eat it by keeping them focused and making a bit of sense, but making sure they kind of show everything off. Yeah. And also just constantly changing directors, and the fact that the book series hadn't finished when they started.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what would be significant.
But I think it's worth, you know, it's worth mentioning that the films are good. We're not trying to, you know, so anyone who loves the films, that's great. You know, I watched them all. I got very emotional. I thought that they were very, very good. But as standalone adaptation, they were companion pieces. They were not actually, they don't really work that well on their own. And I actually think, I say this regularly, I would love to have a TV series of Harry Potter. I'd love it to be an animated TV series, like a cartoon series of Harry Potter, because I think that would actually work really well.
I was going to mention TV shows in a second. I just wanted to say something on Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Is that some of my favorite moments aren't in the books. For example, the one of the bits that makes me cry more than anything is when Hermione removes the memory of her from her parents.
And
that gets mentioned in the books, but I do think that's an example of when films can add to a story.
I agree.
I think they maybe didn't show that enough, because the books, Kate, stay very trapped on Harry, his own experiences and his own point of view.
It's all told from his point of view, pretty much, except for like the small snippets you get. So yeah, the films are kind of, are the door opens a little bit for them, because they don't have to be stuck on point of view. They can actually show the reader something, or rather the audience something, beyond what is seen from the eyes of the main character, which is a good tool to have.
And I wish they had maybe used that more, but I think adaptations should be for the people that haven't read the books rather than view them.
Yeah. Well, I think at this point, though, Harry Potter was so widely read. It was so popular. I mean, as far as the first film, actually, is very close to the book.
Yeah.
But also could be watched entirely on its own. It did make sense entirely on its own. And I think as Harry Potter came into fame and more people had read it, yeah, the chances of people watching it who'd already read the books, you know, just rose significantly.
It's different. Like, I'm not angry about the adaptations, because I do not envy anyone trying to adapt the books. I think it's almost impossible, unless like a TV series. And I wanted to talk about TV series, because adapting books was always considered something you'd put into films. But I feel the real resurgence of a television adaptation is something I really appreciate in the last few years.
Yes, and there is a series that Hamish in particular wants to talk about, and I wouldn't mind talking about it as well. And that is that we've actually had a very recent adaptation of a series of children's books. which is a series of unfortunate events.
Which was what? It was adapted. What?
So it's the non-committal grunt, like you don't love it.
No, the Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events books were my Harry Potter, I suppose, growing up. And I actually really liked the film they made, which adapted three books in one.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I think, is an example of how you can make a film that's very faithful to the characters and the tone if you don't have the ability to be faithful to the story structure or something. It felt very complete, and I never thought we'd ever get it again, another adaptation. So I kind of learnt to like even the elements I didn't when it first came around.
Mm-hmm.
But we suddenly got they're doing it fully on, almost faithful to the point of, I don't know. I do actually think after watching the new Netflix series where they're adapting each book as 2 45-minute plus episodes,
mm-hmm.
that I actually appreciate some of the briskness of the film, because especially in the first three book adaptations, because they were in the film and because I know those ones so well, I was sometimes wanting the scenes to move along a bit. I was like, I know, okay, come on.
Yeah, but, see, for me, because I saw the film once and I'd read the books ages and ages ago. I was most excited for Uncle Monty, not going to lie, because he's my favourite. But
no, it was a really good series. And when the series was announced, my reaction was, oh, great, season two will be amazing. Season one feels like a necessary thing to get through,
yeah,
in order to get to the stuff that's not been touched yet.
Yeah.
See, I'm at a disadvantage. I saw the film and I really enjoyed it. I haven't ever got around to reading the books yet, although they're on my to-be-read pile. And I haven't yet watched the series, although I'm aware of it and I intend to watch it. But the series I'm actually really looking forward to is the BBC adaptation of His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman.
Yes. And that is an example of another thing where the film adaptation faced many problems. had some things which were nice, but I don't think captured anything that resembled what people like about the books, maybe.
No, yeah. And to be fair, it got an awful lot of blowback from some of the Christian community because of the subject matter of the books.
Mm.
And I don't think that was the only reason they didn't go on to make the next film that was planned after that, but that was probably the final nail in the coffin. So that is one where it is too big a subject really for just three films, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something about the structure of a TV show that very, very much resembles the structure of a book, with chapters being episodes.
Yeah.
That a film doesn't have quite the same, you really do have to break down the structure and remake it for a film.
Yeah.
Or
do, you know, the Lord of the Rings thing and just have the film be several hours long.
Yes. I mean, Lord of the Rings is something I want to talk about, because not necessarily Lord of the Rings, but because of the success of those films, I feel transplanting that trilogy's tone onto an adaptation of The Hobbit, which I feel is a very different book,
yeah,
was, in my opinion, a mistake.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with you.
I got the impression that he just wanted to make a film entitled The Battle of the Five Armies and then felt he had to get through all this other stuff first.
Yeah.
Well, I think there was a money element as well, which is that it made sense for them to adapt the Lord of the Rings books into three films because there were three books, and it did not make sense to adapt The Hobbit, which was a short book, it's not exactly a long book, into three films. They had to add so much extra content, and really it felt more like an adaptation of Lord of the Rings than it did of The Hobbit itself.
It was very strange because it's one of the few examples of an adaptation adding so much more, and it has every single moment in the books adapted in painstaking detail,
yeah.
But that doesn't translate to the same feeling you get when you read the books.
No.
So when you read The Hobbit, it really does feel like a whimsical, musical, brisk, fun adventure film.
Until everybody dies.
Yeah. Compared to... And The Lord of the Rings is a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree. But The Hobbit was written as a children's book.
Hmm. But I'd feel a bit weird about taking children to see The Hobbit because it's filled with constant decapitations and horror and I don't know. I went to see the middle Hobbit film in an Australian cinema, and the moment when they're all being attacked by giant spiders, someone said, "Oh, that's nothing, mate." Yeah. I don't know. Do you actually know? I read this thing, kind of interesting. In the 60s, the Beatles wanted to adapt Lord of the Rings with Stanley Kubrick and play all of the Hobbits.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
That would have been either amazing or a really glorious mess, but either way, I would have watched it.
Yeah. There's like this parallel universe of all of the strange films that never happened, and I kind of want to visit there. The Nicolas Cage Superman film from the 90s, which is lost. there's always kind of lost projects. That's the thing, like, my view, I really love films. Like, I'm more of a film person than a book person, but I do enjoy a ambitious flop mess as much as a wonderful, perfect, flawless film. So I actually appreciate some of the terrible adaptations over the years. You can learn a lot more from them than perhaps a perfect film.
Yeah, you can.
Something that's been happening a lot in the young adult fantasy scene recently is there have been a lot of reworkings of material that's out of copyright. So Alice in Wonderland is the prime example. There have been so many, you know, reworkings of that story, and Wizard of Oz to a certain extent as well. And the most recent one is Phantom of the Opera has been reworked as well. Sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't. And I've read two recently. One was Heartless by Marissa Meyer, which is the origin story of the Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland. I wasn't terribly impressed, I have to be honest. And part of the reason is it was heading towards a predetermined destination because, you know, if she's going to end up being the Queen of Hearts we know and love, for lack of a better word, in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, then, you know, the idea was how she got there. And the result was such a claustrophobic book with a thoroughly unlikable, unsympathetic, unrelatable character that just made me so angry that half the time I was shutting the book because it was stressing me out. And I had to finish it because it was a copy given to me by NetGalley. So
I do think people need to learn what backstory is, which is story that is not interesting enough to be the main story. It's the stuff that happens before the bit where the book gets interesting.
The other one I read recently, which was also given to me by NetGalley, so I had to finish that one as well, which is a reworking of The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston Leroux, and it's called Roseblood, and that was by A.G. Howard. And basically, it's sort of like Phantom of the Opera set in the modern day. The old Phantom actually didn't die at the end of The Phantom of the Opera, as it were. And this girl finds out that she's ultimately... there's spoilers for anyone who does actually want to read this book, by the way. Okay, so long as you've gone. basically, she finds out that she's a psychic vampire, just like The Phantom of the Opera, and just like...
Hang on, I missed something here. What?
No, we all missed it. That book, it was some... admittedly, the original book, The Phantom of the Opera, is a very weird book. I think quite a lot of laudanum was involved in writing it. And I'm okay with that, considering the time period. But Roseblood was just... it was a mess, and it wasn't a good mess either. It was weird in a very non-good way. It always felt like the action was taking place off-screen, and we were watching all the uninteresting parts. And it just sort of pick and mixed lots of different things, random bits of folklore. It was an ambitious project. It wasn't a great mess, ultimately.
Yeah, my favourite Phantom of the Opera adaptation is a film called Phantom of the Paradise, which is a glam rock 70s musical version, which I think was released as a double picture with Rocky Horror Picture Show. So that kind of gives you an idea of the tone. and it's, I would never say, oh, it's a perfect adaptation. It's very loose. But I think there's something interesting about those kind of gothic horror characters like Dracula and Frankenstein, is that there seems to be an adaptation coming out every year.
Yeah.
Well, I've been teaching, I just finished teaching a module all about the gothic and adapting the gothic, oddly enough. And our set texts were The Hound of the Baskervilles, Dracula. Thank God we didn't do Wuthering Heights, because Jules knows how I feel about that.
We all do.
That being said, I have read some very good Wuthering Heights adaptations, so I'm just going to leave that there. Dracula, Hound of the Baskervilles, Town of the Screw, and there was another one we also looked at, Salem's Lot. And it is a really popular thing to do at the moment, and I guess that the gothic is actually something that's really easy to adapt. Because it's such a flexible kind of genre, and it's kind of really appealing for this new fad of dark fantasy. I've been marking the papers, and some of them have just been superb. The ideas that people are coming out with, these classic novels. So people complain about adaptation, you know, saying that it's not original, and I would argue against that. The adaptations, perfect adaptations, are the ones which understand the vision or the audience that you are aiming it toward. Whether or not you stay true to the original, it's more about sort of understanding what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it, and whether you can do that successfully. It's why you can have very, very funny, you know, adaptations of Dracula, which are just slapstick comedy, and don't necessarily have all of the, but they've drawn on what could be used in the original to make it actually funny. And I think actually a good example of an adaptation which is both faithful and also really understands its audience is Les Misérables.
Yeah. Obviously not really speculative, but yeah.
No, it's not speculative fiction, but you know, we talked a little bit about the stage, so I'll just mention Les Misérables very quickly. Les Mis as a book is a tomb. It's pretty chunky, let's not lie. But the musical is exceptional. And the thing is that the really funny thing about the musical is, if you listen to recordings from the one, you know, some of the earlier kind of staging of it, and they've got synths, and it's kind of funky music instead. Like, you listen to it now and it's all orchestral and powerful and stuff, and then you listen to sort of some of the original sort of stagings of it, and it's really kind of upbeat, almost, yeah. I've listened to some of the original French staging of it, and it's kind of almost discotheque kind of music in the background. And it's just like, they understood what the audience wanted at the time.
I it always surprises me in Phantom of the Opera that most of the musical is fairly, you know, era appropriate, and then halfway through there's just an 80s pop song.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, and it's why people like Phantom of the Opera, but it's definitely a kind of tonal shift. Yeah. Actually, I wanted to talk a bit more just about how one thing that's interesting about gothic characters like Dracula and Frankenstein is how often they're put together and considered the same universe.
Yes.
So even in sort of the first black and white films, they'd have their meeting, and in recent things like Penny Dreadful and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and things, people seem to just accept that they're part of the same world, which I find kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing about that is particularly this merger of Dracula and Frankenstein. And again, I think we've spoken about this before on Dissecting Dragons, is the essence of what those two stories are about. And Frankenstein is very much you know, the future is here, the future is now, and it's terrifying, and oh God, no, we shouldn't go near it, because, you know, it's future innovation that creates Frankenstein in the end. Whereas Dracula is the total opposite. It's, oh God, the past is here, the past is coming after us, we need to go to the future for the answers. And, you know, all the good guys are using all this technological advancement to try and beat Dracula. And it's quite interesting, because they literally have opposite messages, and yet the two characters are often lumped together.
One of the strangest adaptations I've ever seen of anything was a few years ago, the BBC thought it would be a really cool thing to do, to do a broadcast live Frankenstein musical to the music of Snow Patrol and Elbow in a church, in a church, taking the entire events of the entire book and setting it on the day of Victor Frankenstein's wedding.
That's really weird.
And do it and take it incredibly seriously.
BBC, what the hell?
It's all on YouTube. It's called Frankenstein's Wedding, and I actually think it works, but I do not know how that could have possibly be pitched. Also, the story is now set in present day.
This I have to see.
I have no idea how that got commissioned, when it seems really hard to commission the most safest of projects, but apparently that happened and it was great. And it was an interactive experience as well. It had dance moves and sing-along moments.
Awesome.
What?
Yeah, it's very strange, but it's interesting how you can just take a very old book that seems to have been done 100 times and find a new way to do it and kind of make it work.
Yeah. I have to say, one of my favourite adaptations is the Jeff Wayne musical of War of the Worlds.
Ah, yes. War of the Worlds is it's a book I really enjoy. And it's definitely something that's never been, I feel, done faithfully, in the sense I've never seen a Victorian War of the Worlds story. But I actually quite like a lot of the adaptations for different reasons.
Yeah, me too. I do feel that the musical's sort of set Victorian times, isn't it? And I suppose in a way, I'm not saying it's a more faithful adaptation, but I feel in some ways it captures the spirit, and weirdly putting songs and music in there somehow makes the whole idea of it more terrifying.
Yeah, I making something into a musical, I feel musicals could be a whole episode, but obviously it's a choice. Books aren't musicals. So you have to really think, does this feel like a musical? I think, for example, The Hobbit feels like a musical because it has a song every couple of chapters written out for you.
Whereas Lord of the Rings, the musical, didn't really work.
No.
In my opinion.
It's not the same thing. Like The Wizard of Oz, I understand why they made a musical of it. It makes sense.
Yeah.
I'd like to see more things adapted into musicals which you don't get that from the book at all. Because I just I like a hot mess of an adaptation, so.
What's the hottest mess of any adaptation you've ever seen or read?
I don't know. I'm quite deep in superhero movies, so I might be in that kind of world. But actually, I could go on and on about Batman, for example, but Batman's an interesting character in that I do think Lego Batman movies and the Adam West 60s show and the Christopher Nolan trilogy and all things, I feel like valid adaptations of the source material, because it's a character that's done a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's the worst adaptation you think you've seen?
Jules, you go first.
I'm just thinking.
I mean, a lot of them are bad, and we've been quite complimentary so far.
I think most of the worst adaptations for me, it's very personal, because it's a case of somebody's taken something where I'm really invested in the source material, and it wasn't that I wanted them to follow it exactly, but I did want them to capture the spirit of it. And my absolute worst one is not speculative at all, but somebody did it's almost like really bad fan fiction of Jane Eyre, and they set it as, you know, a 17-year-old girl going off to a boarding school. She's supposed to be really, really intelligent. It takes her something like 6 months to read Jane Eyre just once. And meantime, she suffers a head injury, and whenever it gives her something like narcolepsy, and every time she falls asleep, she finds herself like stuck in this Jane Eyre narrative, having to be this 19th century governess. And I don't know, it just shows a complete lack of any understanding for the original book at all, and I was offended by it.
I'm trying to think of any bad sort of adaptations that I've seen that have really, and like, for some reason I can sort of remember experiencing them, but I can't actually remember what I was watching or reading, because I must have just sort of thrown it from my mind.
See, I've actually got the skill of, if I really am not interested in a film, I can forget that I'm watching it and forget that I've seen it as I'm watching it.
Yeah, exactly. No, but see, that's the thing. I've kind of got that, where I can remember sort of feeling, oh, this is awful, but I don't actually remember what it was that I was watching, because I just sort of like just threw it out of the window of my mind.
Delete, delete.
Yeah, delete. I do not want to have to even think about this.
I think that's why I'm more unforgiving about books, because I've got a slightly weird memory for words. So if it's a book, then I'm probably not ever going to forget it. And then I get quite resentful if they've really messed it up.
I can only think of bad remakes, of which there are plenty of. I feel like there's always a little bit of weird joy out of seeing something adapted and seeing characters. Okay, go on.
No, sorry. I was going to say, first of all, too, I never read the book, so I wasn't that emotionally invested, but Aragorn was a bad movie.
Mm.
But actually, the most recent adaptation that I feel the most betrayed by is the latest series of Sherlock.
Okay, I still haven't watched that yet, so no one spoil me.
No spoilers. Why do I feel that I've been betrayed? Possibly because of the characterization. You know, this isn't just the latest series, it's been happening over time. When I first watched the first series of Sherlock, I felt that the characters are actually quite accurate, in at least that they seem like the youngest version of themselves that you sort of get introduced to in the books. But and actually, a lot of the Sherlock Holmes, I don't mind seeing different kinds of versions of Sherlock. I actually really like the Robert Downey Jr. version. Because I think it's quite fun, and actually they have managed to... They've got Watson down quite well in that, in at least that Watson was meant to be the, you know, the good-looking... he was meant to be the normal one, and Sherlock is meant to be the really kind of weird one. But I think actually the most faithful adaptation to date since the Jeremy Brett series of Sherlock that I've ever watched is Elementary, the American Sherlock, which I thought was going to be awful. And even though it is quite episodic at the end of the day, and, you know, it's a little bit samey, I feel that the characters are the most accurate representations from the book that we've seen since we had Basil the Great Mouse Detective and we had the Granada Jeremy Brett Holmes, honestly.
I do think when you're adapting something and making an obvious change, such as making him a mouse or making it set in modern day, you have to work extra hard to make sure that the personality of the character is accurate.
Whereas
I think sometimes maybe people just put a deerstalker on a guy in Victorian London and made him solve crimes and didn't really pay attention to
the most criminal thing is making Watson a bumbling idiot, which always really annoyed me, because he's not, he's very heroic, and he is smart. It's just that Sherlock Holmes is a weirdo. So I'm totally with you on that. And again, I don't mind Sherlock sort of being changed to someone who's eccentric and possibly a little bit overbearing, because he's actually quite nice in the original stories. As I said, I like the Robert Downey Jr. version very much, but I just feel like... some of the latest episodes of Sherlock, the BBC series, it just got a little bit like the characters almost became caricatures of themselves.
There's a term I've noticed when studying film and TV called flanderizing, which comes from the idea that in season one of The Simpsons, Ned Flanders was, his thing was he was a nice neighbor to contrast how The Simpsons were bad people. But over the years has become a right-wing conservative Christian, kind of very protective and overbearing of his children. And everything that made him the normal character to begin with has become exaggerated. So the term flanderizing is used when talking about TV shows a lot, where when they come back to write future series, they take the tiny elements that were subtle to begin with and make that the whole character.
Yeah.
And I think that is a problem possibly in books as well, but I see it happens more frequently in the films, I suppose, and TV.
Yeah. Especially happens when they don't have a script that they're working towards, you know. If they had a series where they knew it, where everything was kind of going, it's when you're sort of making up content as you go that this flanderizing actually starts to happen, I find. And so you do get it in long-running TV series, such as in Bones, that they're quite bad with that now. And I'm not even going to mention Supernatural.
It happens very frequently in sitcoms where one character in season one is the least intelligent of the group, but by the end of the series will be the stupidest person that has ever lived on the history of the planet. And yeah. And you start to wonder how they even function when we're not seeing them. So I think when adapting, sometimes people make caricatures out of quite nuanced characters.
Yeah, I agree.
I hate to say this, but we have been talking for over an hour, which has been great, but we're going to have to wrap it up.
That's absolutely fine.
Well, before we do, Hamish, would you like to give our listeners some information of where they can find out a little bit more about you or follow you on social media?
Yeah, I tend to be Hamish Steele on all the things. And I would like to use this time to ask people to check out Pantheon by Hamish Steele. Maybe check it out on Amazon. It comes out on April 1st. And also maybe name drop my own podcast, which I do. Is that all right?
How dare you?
I'm sorry. I'm cheating on you with my own podcast.
I'm an avid listener of your podcast.
So. We've only just started. It was very much influenced by my utter respect at the commitment and sort of everything you do at Dissecting Dragons.
Ticking the right boxes.
Our show is called Box Not Included, and it examines geek culture and the media we love and loathe from an LGBT perspective every week, I suppose. So yeah, that's what I like to plug.
We'll share a little bit more information about Box Not Included on the Dissecting Dragons page as well. So if you want to go over and check it out, it's a great little podcast. I've been enjoying the episodes. And yeah, thank you very much for coming back onto the show, Hamish.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem.
Best of luck with Pantheon. I look forward to getting hold of my... It's because it's full colour now, isn't it?
Yes, it was originally black and white, but I've made it all colour and added in a couple of extra chapters and... etc.
Excellent. I cannot wait to see that scene in full colour.
The scene.
You know the scene I mean.
I've heard about this scene. I'm looking forward to this.
And on that note, we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah. Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.